Hey, what's up, you sexy bitches, and welcome back to this week's Weekly D, where today I have Carolina, aka Blogger on Pole, joining me to talk about the trials and tribulations of being on Instagram. Carolina has done so much good work, and I'm so excited for you to hear about this. So, without further ado, this is the Weekly D, because, honey, if you ain't getting your D on the daily, you better at least begin it once on the weekly.
If you're not getting any and you want some tea, then come and join Dan up on the Weekly D. It's the Weekly D.
Hey, Carolina, aka Blogger on Pole. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm really good, thank you. Thank you for having me. Really excited about this chat.
Oh, no, thank you so much for joining me. Before we get started, I'd like to, obviously, we're here to talk a bit about Instagram, all the amazing work that you've been doing with Instagram, and sort of like the posts, very educational posts that you've been doing on Instagram about this whole situation. Before we go into all the details of that, I kind of just want to give you an opportunity to kind of do like an intro. I normally get people just to have like a, hey, this is me, this is what I do. So yeah, give us a little bit of an intro to who you are and what you do.
Yeah, thank you so much. So I'm Dr. Carolina Are. I like to call myself a pole dancing academic, meaning that I am a researcher. My full-time job is that of an innovation fellow, which is a really like fancy word for postdoctoral researcher. So the kind of research you do after your PhD. And I'm based at a research center at Northumbria University, but I work remotely from London. But at the same time, I'm a pole dancer. I used to be a regular pole instructor, but because work has taken over, I'm kind of teaching just workshops every now and then. And I'm a content creator myself through the blog, Blogger on Pole, and the associated social media platforms. And I guess you could say that I'm an anti-censorship activist. So I focus on making sure that we're all having a better and freer experience online, which sadly doesn't always happen because that doesn't depend on me, but it depends on the major tech lizards that are running social media platforms.
Mm-hmm. And when you started your journey, blogging was kind of like your main first thing you did. So is that how the name Blogger on Pole came about? Is that how you started with pole as a blogging pole dancer?
So it was a bit it was a bit of a decision that I had to make when I first started my PhD, because initially I was just on social media as myself, but with like a fake surname, which is what I used on social media all the time, because starting back or retraining rather as an academic, I was working in PR and communications and marketing and whatever. And I vividly remember at uni that everybody was like, oh my God, your employer can find you on social media. So I always went with a fake name. But then when I started posting about pole, and I was a travel blogger at the time, a travel and lifestyle blogger, I noticed that my account was growing, that a lot of people were resonating with the things that I was talking about. So I was kind of like, I don't write about travel as much. And I'm actually not enjoying going to restaurants literally every evening. It's actually really tiring. What I do mostly with my life now is pole. So I rebranded my blog while at the same time making a conscious decision to split my pole life from my academic life, because I didn't know how researchers or professors or anybody that I was working with really at the moment was going to react to it. Also, I was about to go into teaching undergrads at university, so I was kind of like, do I want my students to look at my ass straight away? Maybe not yet. So that's where I kind of rebranded my existing blog, which was a travel blog, as Blogger on Pole. And I know a lot of people say, why is it not Blogger on a Pole? But actually, it's a weird kind of throwback to my BA journalism days, because it sounds more like a newspaper headline if you say Blogger on Pole. So that's why it was like that. But I think the blogging just became part of the journey of just sharing my experiences as a pole dancer, coming from a background of healing from an abusive relationship. So how pole was helping me with that. And then it kind of took over. And obviously, as much as I like writing and I see myself as a writer and a blogger first, to get your writing seen by anybody, you have to share it via social media. So obviously, social media then took over, if that makes sense.
Right. And yeah, so obviously the blogging was kind of like the first thing that you started with, and then you moved into kind of like the activism side. Did you start with the activism just with the sort of social media activism, or have you taken part in any other type, like any other type of activism at all, or anything not related to pole maybe?
I mean, it's a bit strange sometimes to talk about social media activism, right? Because you could argue that then we're all activists because we have a profile, right? And right. I think it doesn't always translate into that. Like sometimes activism means going to protests, or sometimes it means helping out at, you know, community centers. Like there are so many people who do brilliant activism and don't feel like they have to shout out about it. I think the reason why I do it so publicly is because I have a platform and it makes sense with what I'm doing because it is about social media. That being said, before I started on the anti-censorship stuff, I think a lot of what I was doing was raising awareness about domestic violence, about sexual assault, basically the experiences that I had in my abusive relationship. And I'm actually kind of grateful, though, that as much as I do still share that kind of stuff, that is not my main beat, because I think there's a lot of really horrible people on social media that target specifically those that do that type of activism. And I think these people that keep raising awareness about this stuff, despite maybe being triggered by it because it's their own experience, I think they're so brave. It's just that I don't really feel that that is my field, because yes, I have personal experience, but I don't have research experience or like community experience with that, because I just can't put myself through that. So I kind of veered out of that.
And you mean like because people are that, like when you're posting about these sort of things, people are coming at you with negative comments, you mean, not supportive?
Yeah, so I remember you know, there was this one time, for instance, where, you know, it was just post Me Too, and I had started sharing my own experiences, and even just on my Facebook, like writing blog posts about the blurry line of consent, particularly when, you know, maybe your abusive partner is someone you've previously consented to, or when there is a power imbalance between maybe someone a bit famous and you, or, you know, like on the back of the Aziz Ansari allegations and stuff. And I remember there were two people on my Facebook as well, so not even on my Instagram, hell-bent in the comments on kind of basically questioning everything I said, but not questioning in a helpful way, kind of like, have you thought about this or have you thought about that? Let's have a conversation. But it was a very like not all men kind of vibe. And it became this very public standoff. And I was like, it's really triggering for me. It's really triggering for everybody involved. Like, why am I doing this kind of thing? And this is why I think everybody who does it is really brave. But, you know, even by just talking about feminism, there's people who search for those keywords on social media to then vomit abuse on those pages. So I'm kind of like, you know, I will dip into it when I need to. But other than that.
It's funny how people go to that sort of like, not all men. It's like with the racism thing, people are like, oh, not all white people are racist. It's like, no one's saying that. Where do people get that from? No one said it. Like, so when people are like, oh, not all men, it's like, no one said it was all men.
Yeah, I know.
So why do they feel the need to speak up with some of that? It really complicates the whole situation. This makes me wonder why, if they contributed that, of all things they could contribute, that's all they had to contribute.
I mean,
so annoying.
I understand how some people who were maybe from a dominant category before now feel like they're the bad guy, or like they're being questioned just because of who they are. Like that can be really tricky. But at the same time, if you've been in a dominant category, maybe that is time to do some, I don't know, introspection and self-reflection and be like, how have I contributed to that? Because I, you know, I know a lot of lovely men who will step in and fight for women. But I think at the same time, there's also a growing population of online activists that are actually pushing this narrative that women are trying to take power away from men, or that they're trying to ruin men's lives with accusations of assault. And as someone who had to go through, you know, police accusations of assault and then pulled back because the police themselves were like, oh, no one's going to believe you. Why are you even bothering? I would not wish that on anyone. So I doubt there are many women out there who will want to go through that just to ruin someone's life. It's actually a really difficult thing to prove. So yeah, I think a lot of it comes from people fostering hate online. A lot of it comes from fear. A lot of it comes from a breakdown in communications. And I think also, although that is changing, there are a lot of really positive women role models out there, but there are very few men role models that are not incendiary, like Andrew Tate. So I really, really admire those men that are putting themselves out there and are saying, there's a different type of masculinity that we can aspire to that isn't just this toxic dude.
I'm really intrigued to know your opinion on this. I've never actually spoken about him. If I'm honest, I don't know much about Andrew Tate, or you don't. I don't really care to find out more. But from what I have seen and heard, do you not think that actually he maybe doesn't even believe some of that stuff? He does it just purely as a marketing tool to get his name spread around a bit more? Because I feel like it's, I always very much, whenever I saw these videos, I always thought, this guy doesn't believe that. I genuinely think that maybe he doesn't believe that, but actually he is doing it because he wants the drama. He wants people to be going to his page and he wants to cause a divide. I think it was a marketing thing. I don't know, what's your views on it?
So I'm actually in between, in the sense that partly I agree with you, like this man makes money through clicks. He has a platform. So through his education platform, he brings people to buy his courses, right? So obviously there's an interest, kind of like us, you know, like we care about expressing ourselves so much through Paul, but at the same time, we sell classes, we sell whatever we sell, right? We sell clothing, we sell experiences. So I think there comes a point where the persona is blended with the money. I think he has a track record and a history of those views. So partly there's that. Part of me also thinks that he kind of self-radicalized in a way, like he got a following from what he was saying. So that makes you feel like you're God, right? Like, oh my God, like people love what I do. So I think like it's almost like a loop of things that are feeding themselves. And I think definitely then there's a lot of organizations and there's a lot of political parties or even just beliefs that thrive off of that type of content, right? So it's been proven that incels and like this kind of women hating behavior is a gateway for young boys into the alt-right. So of course then you're kind of wondering, where does one start and the other one end? So it's something that I watch from afar with concern. And like I, you know, there used to be a time, my PhD was actually on online abuse and conspiracy theories, but I never published from it because it was on a very specific high profile criminal case. And everybody that published from like about those people got trolled for life. Like, one researcher comes to mind who got like hundreds of daily phone calls. They tried to get him fired from his institution. They tried to get him removed from the British Psychological Association. So I have nothing published out of that because I didn't want that kind of harassment. But what I did notice is that then when you believe in something so much, then it's a gateway into other conspiracy theories. So there was a time, or you know, really harmful beliefs and behaviors. So there was a time where I was looking at this stuff really closely. And then I just thought, actually, I can make much more impact by researching on censorship, because it's something that I experience and it's something that my community experiences. And as much as I will probably get hate for that one way or another, it's not in the same league.
Mm. Do you ever get hate for the research and stuff that you do on the Instagram censorship and stuff? I'm intrigued. I'm trying to think of a situation where anyone in the pole community would be offended by what you're doing. But this is the internet, so I thought I'd check, because there's always someone. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm intrigued to know any pushback you get from the work you're doing.
I think, like, the hate I get is not necessarily, or the pushback, it's not even hate, it's not necessarily from the pole community, but sometimes you get, like, bros in the comments. It's usually always a bro who's like, have you thought about going onto another platform? Have you thought, like, these people should not be posting this stuff? Won't somebody think of the children? That's the kind of pushback that you get from people that think they have a solution, but they don't really, because they don't really know the field. They're just there to troll. I think sometimes, and I completely understand that, the kind of pushback that I get sometimes is from people that have been way more censored than I have, like from, you know, sex workers who rightly say, you know, why are people listening to this bitch when actually we've been censored since forever? And I think that's fair, you know, like I come to it from a very privileged position as a researcher and as a pole dancer with no lived experiences of sex work. So the censorship that I get is an extension of the issue that sex workers are facing, but it's nowhere near what they're facing. So I can understand how it can be really annoying for people to listen to me while there are so many people with lived experiences that they could be listening to, which is why, as much as I can, when I'm being interviewed, I try to also share the contacts of people that do want to talk to media about it. Or, you know, in my recent research workshops, I've just essentially paid a variety of censored users to come together and try to co-design solutions from their lived experiences. Because another issue with the fact that a lot of sex workers don't get enough airtime is that their relationship with the media is very fraught. So obviously, the media have been sensationalizing the lives of sex workers, which is really harmful to them. And also, a lot of them can't really speak on the record because they're not out to their families, or it's not safe for them to speak on the record. So what happens is then the relationship with the media is bad already. And then there's all of these factors that make sex workers struggle to actually speak to the media. So people who do speak to the media are vanilla people like me. And this perpetrates the cycle of who gets heard. But I think there's a lot of amazing work being done in this field by sex worker activists and sex work researchers. So I'm talking of, you know, United Sex Workers, the East London Strippers Collective. So these are proper unions that speak on the record. But then there's Zara Stardust, Dr. Zara Stardust. Dr. Zara Stardust in Australia, and Hacking Hustling in the US, who are amazing researchers that focus on the lived experiences of sex workers and who are or were sex workers themselves. So slowly this is changing. But I think that's the kind of pushback I get. And then obviously, you know, I get hate on TikTok for being a woman with her ass out. Like, I get rape threats on TikTok. So.
Oh, God. Wow, like, TikTok is just, it's a weird space. Like, I like it for me because the content that I view on there is quite fun. I've managed to get my algorithms on TikTok showing me really fun stuff. So when I just need some fun, I go to TikTok because I don't really post much on there. Whereas obviously on Instagram, my algorithms just show me poll. So obviously I'm just be like, oh, don't want poll, I just go to TikTok. So that's kind of where all the stuff that I like and I share tends to be non-poll stuff. So that's kind of like my happy place, but I have seen the downsides of TikTok. I think before we go any further on this topic, because we are kind of already going into it, but can you just tell people like what it is that you're doing with your Instagram sort of like activism, like, and what it is that you're in the process of doing and the contact that you're having with them, and just to kind of give, because if anyone's listening to this and they're like, what the hell are they talking about? It would just be a really good kind of like, you know, bit of info for them, I think.
Yeah, sure. So way I started my project at my research center was to explore the experiences of censorship I've had and that a lot of pole dancers, sex workers, and sex positive users have had from an insider's perspective. So because I was witnessing those things happen to my account, like shadow banning, like mass reporting, deplatforming, I was kind of like, how do we move this from my own experience and to the experiences of actual people who are going through this so that we have a variety of case studies to present to these companies? Now, it's very difficult, even as a researcher and as an established researcher, to have any form of contact with social media platforms. So social media platforms, when they give interviews, often they speak on background, which means that they send you something and then you have to paraphrase it and you can't attribute it to a single person there, which is something that evades accountability. And as a researcher, it's even harder because then you would have to interview these people to get content about how platforms work to use in your research. This is not something that they do or that they have done much with me. Now, I have been speaking with Instagram since 2019. And this has not always been from an activist or researcher perspective. So for some of you who may remember this, in 2019, there was a petition that you, Dan, were one of the first people to sign. You were one of the people who launched it, essentially, for Instagram to stop shadow banning pole dance. And this was a really cool team effort. I remember there was you, there was Michelle Shimi, there was AM Davis from UPA at the time, United Pole Artists, a variety of really high profile pole dancers. And I came on board at the time because I was already speaking to Instagram. At the time, I was speaking to Instagram Press, which is something very different. So this is like their PR department. These are not people who make decisions. These are people who speak to journalists. So I spoke to them because I wanted to explain what shadow banning was and how it was affecting us in an easy way that blended my previous experience as a PR and social media person with my research experience and with my censored user experience. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to like bitch on Instagram in this blog post. What did I learn when I was working in PR and in journalism that I need to give them the right to reply? Because otherwise, you know, by essentially just writing a rant, you could even go through some legal drama. So I didn't want that. So I wrote to their press email address thinking that my back was going to be covered, because after you write Instagram declined to comment or they didn't respond to this email, then you're covered because you've done your due diligence. Strangely enough, though, they replied. So if you remember, when we got that apology from Instagram, when the petition reached about 20,000 signatures, and when we presented all our collective questions to Instagram and they apologized, that was through my press contact. So this press contact was like a separate agency that they had contracted, essentially. So it was no one within Instagram. So every time we would ask questions about how does this actually take place? How is this censorship happening? How are these posts being picked up by the algorithm? They couldn't and wouldn't tell us. So they would just recycle some PR messaging, right? So then fast forward to post-pandemic, where I'd kind of, well, not post-pandemic, but like, let's say end of 2020, when I'd joined my academic and my pole persona. And at the same time, I had launched that bigger petition that reached over 120,000 signatures about the new terms of use. So through that, and through an academic contact, I was able to speak at someone at Meta Policy. So policy is different. So policy are the people who make the rules, right? The people who write the community guidelines. So that kickstarted a conversation where they would explain some policies to me. And sometimes they would reverse deletions of accounts that were made an error. So this is where I started being able to help people as an intermediary, which is something I do for free as a volunteer. I don't get paid for it. I know some people think that I work for Meta. I don't. I just communicate with them and I am able to expedite the process. But this is completely up in the air in the sense that they decide when to restore the account. They decide when to look into the account. All I can do is send an email, but that doesn't mean that that gets action straight away or ever. Mm-hmm. So that started a conversation. But again, because I was an independent researcher, it took me about a year and a half to find a full-time postdoc position, maybe because my ass was out on the internet, who knows, but it took me quite a while. It was still like a very shaky relationship with Meta, because it was always like, okay, like, we're going to answer your email, we're going to have a few meetings with you, but this doesn't mean that, you know, we think you're, like, I think they did think I was legit, but they didn't know where they had me. They didn't know if I was a crazy activist that was just going to, like, break into their offices or something. And then when I got my postdoc position, which started in April last year, so April 2022, I think I got a new contact there, and that's where things started changing, in the sense that they listened to me a little bit more, and they saw that I was actively publishing research that was not just about my own experiences, but about other people's experiences as well. And I think that's probably when they thought, okay, she's more of a researcher than an activist, which I don't necessarily agree with, because I'd like to think I'm both, but also I'd like to think that activists are as important to speak to as researchers. But that's where then it led up to me being able to go into Meta's offices in November last year to feedback on their nudity and sexual activity and sexual solicitation policies. Now, again, I feedback on those. So I'm like, I don't agree with this. According to my participants, this and this is not helpful to anyone. But the fact that I feedback to them doesn't mean that they have to listen. So again, as much as I have a foot in the door, it doesn't mean that they have to do anything I say. It doesn't mean that it changes anything, but it's a contact that some people may not have.
Mm-hmm. I think I really struggle with the whole thing with it, because it's a difficult one, because it's a free platform. This isn't a platform that people are paying to use. So I assume this is probably something that you've been asked before, so I'm going to ask it to you. It's not something that I necessarily agree with myself, but I'm more just intrigued to know how you would respond to someone who said this. What do you think about people who feel that, you know, the platform is free, it's a public forum, and they own the business, it's their business, they should be able to decide what's on there and what isn't, and if they don't want, I don't know, sex workers on there or people with their butts out, they should be allowed to do that. And the only example that I try to think of is like, if I went to a club, for example, and I was trying to get people to, and if I was trying to sell sex there, I was trying to be like, oh, you know, I offer these services to all the people in the club, I'd be kicked out. And like, if I was half naked in a club, I'd be kicked out, you know, and we think of that as pretty normal within a club setting. What makes it different with Instagram?
So this is a really interesting and important question, I think. And there isn't one straight answer, in the sense that, yes, they own the company, so they can decide to do what they want. But I think the conflict lies within their initial pitch to the masses, right? When Facebook itself started as a company, they loved to bask into the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street light. They were like, oh, we are a platform for freedom of expression. Look what we can do. We are amazing. We care about business. We care about creators. We care about free expression. It's like the ultimate American dream, right? This is how they pitched themselves to us. And then it's kind of like, oh, we care about you, but like, not if you're a sex worker, or not if you're like an activist saying things we don't like. So that's where the conflict lies, right? And I think because my first degree was in journalism, I always think that a key aspect of media law and a key defense for journalists when they're being sued in court is actually that someone, whether that's a corporation or a person, is presenting themselves in a light but actually they are not behaving in that way privately or even publicly. So I think there's a public interest there in knowing why certain things fly and certain things don't, which is, you know, again, there are so many online and offline laws about sex work and about content that you can and can't show. There were the porn wars in the US in the 70s about whether porn was freedom of speech, and it was found that porn was freedom of speech. So it's kind of like, well, how does this, you know, relate to what happened offline? Because actually, you can post a lot of things on a billboard that you can't post on Meta-owned platforms. So I think the issue here is them wrecking their brain and trying to figure out, how do we grow massively as a platform? How are we appealing to absolutely everybody in the world and people of all ages that are allowed on this platform while not getting done for it legally? So at the moment, the issue is an image issue for them, an earnings issue for them, and also a governance issue, because what is happening is that they're trying to govern a population which is bigger than one single country in the exact same way. It's kind of saying, like, I don't know, you go to a movie theater and there's sex scenes, and then you get mad because a child runs in. Well, it's kind of like, well, we did say this was like 18 plus. So there's no, even when there is 18 plus content on platforms, they restrict your views massively. So essentially they grew too fast. They grew too much. They are a huge monopoly. They have a monopoly over content and profiles, and they don't know what to do with it. And this is happening at the same time while governments also have no idea what to do with it because they let it fly for too long. So this is why we're seeing more and more regulations come in. And yeah.
I think, so what is the age that you're allowed to be on Instagram?
I think all platforms are mostly 16. PG-13. 13, I think.
A 13. Okay. Yeah. I totally see what you mean. I think it's so difficult because we don't pay for it. I think that's, for me, where the lack of rights comes in. Why is it so hard to contact Instagram? Like, you know, like you were saying, like, I've got an in. Well, that's amazing because I've only ever known one other person who had an in, and that was because she worked for Instagram. And she doesn't anymore, which sucks, because actually I remember I managed to get a few people's accounts back because she was like, oh, if anyone's account ever gets deleted by mistake, just let me know, I'll look into it. And she got a few people's accounts backed. And I was like, that was such a useful contact to have. I'm very lucky in the sense that, I'm lucky in the sense that because I'm a guy, I know it sounds really terrible, but I feel like because I'm a man on a pole, they don't really take much notice of me. I don't think they really care about me, which is great. Please stop noticing me. I don't want to be noticed on Instagram. I was like, please leave me alone, Instagram. But yeah, so I think I have that advantage. So I've never had to get in contact. But when people do get their accounts deleted, I've heard of the process of, like, they have to take a picture of themselves and hold something and send ID. And sometimes they just never even hear back. Like, why is it so hard to get hold of them? Like, how many people do they have working on these teams? They can't have many.
So there have been swathes of massive layoffs at Meta and in big tech in general. So they had promised that there was going to be a deleted creators team where if you worked as a creator professionally and you had a page, then you could reach a customer service team if something happened to your account. That's being scrapped now. So that's not happening anymore. And again, you know, I really empathize and sympathize with the difficulty of moderating this mammoth of a platform with content that goes live every second. But if the algorithms and the machine learning have to be so good at picking up and deleting stuff, then the fallback, or like the, let's say, the balancing act of that has to be that appeals need to be really good. And they're not at the moment. Every single person I've interviewed essentially said that the appeals don't work, like the page glitches. Sometimes they can't even upload ID, either because they can't out themselves because they're not out on, you know, in the world is what they do, or because the page doesn't actually allow them to. So there is a massive glitch there. And I think there's an issue with the platform being created for posting content and not for, you know, what happens when content goes wrong, which is a failure of justice system, if you think about it. Like, even like offline, if you commit a crime and you're sentenced for it, then you have a right to appeal. You currently don't have much of a right to a timely, fast, and efficient appeal on Meta-owned platforms. Also, I find it appalling that if you post a tit on Meta, you are deleted immediately in the same way as someone who has posted a mass shooting. Like, there is no balancing act there. And going back to your point about payment, I do agree that we're probably not getting customer service because we're not paying for the platform. That being said, the way they've been acting in general and their disgust towards nudity in general makes me feel like even if I told people, go pay for Meta Verified and you'll have better customer service, I'm not sure that is going to work for people that Meta don't like already. Plus, I don't know, it just feels like they are a freedom of expression platform. They are providing a service. And of course, yes, they, you know, they are giving us things for free, but they have a whole lot of advertisers and investors that are pouring money into that company. So it's strange to me that a lot of the time they don't see what they're doing as a public service, because it feels like they play it both ways. They like seeing themselves as a public service where great things come out of the platform. But when bad things come out of the platform, we're like, well, there's only so much we can do. So many people are posting on the platform. And I'm like, well, which is which then, you know?
I just find it hard to compare it to, like, you know, sorry, not trying to go against what you're saying here. I find it hard to compare it against things like, what was it you compared against? Like, you know, if you're going to go to trial for, like, if you killed someone or whatever, and you'd have the chance to go to trial. I mean, I think the difference with that is that you'd go to actual prison. Do you know what I mean? Whereas this is just your profile on Instagram. But I feel like we've just gotten to a point where people rely so much on Instagram that it's like having one of your civil rights taken away. And I think we forget that having Instagram is not a civil right. I think that's the problem that I have when I see people getting upset, is I'm just like, hold on, like, we can't get too upset because we don't pay for this service. So it's not a service we pay for. And it's a private company. Like, it's not like, you know, this isn't the government. This isn't our right to have, you know, water, or do you know what I mean? Like, these life essential things. It's social media. But, you know, and I say that, obviously I'd be lost without it because my job requires me to. And I don't know about you, but I'd pay good money to have customer service available to make sure my account didn't get deleted, or if it did, that someone, I'd be able to contact someone. It's a shame, really, that they can't see that there is maybe some value into offering people the chance to pay. Hey, so sorry to interrupt your episode. I just wanted to come on real quickly and tell you about the sponsor for this week's podcast. And this week is sponsored by Poll Active. Poll Active are a US-based one-stop shop for everything you need for pole dancing. And I'm literally looking at their website now. And this shop, I've never seen the shop with so much choice in my life. It is crazy. They've got all sorts of things clothing-wise for pole dancing. They've got accessories for pole dancing. They've got shoes for pole dancing. A range of brands on there. Some of these brands I'd never even heard of before, and I'm learning about them purely from this website. So if you want to go and find out about lots of different pole brands, go and check out Pole Active. Let's get back to the podcast.
In fact, I'm intrigued to know what you know about the Meta Verified thing, because Meta Verified is this new thing that's, I believe it's only rolling out in the US at the moment, and you can pay to be verified, which means you get a blue tick, which to me means nothing. But what it did say was that you get some added benefits to it. Do you know what the benefits are? Do you know anything about it all?
Yeah, so I'll start with that and then I'll go back to what you were saying about it's a social media platform, it's not a civil right. So basically, what happens with the benefits is that technically you get more reach, so your posts are more visible, and also you get better customer service when something happens to your account, or, you know, in terms of online abuse, or essentially you get that little bit of communication that you should already be getting. And this is where it pisses me off, because I'm kind of like, well, you're essentially saying that you would limit my reach unless I pay for it. You're saying that I should pay for attention, right? And then I think another issue with that is that Twitter Blue, which is what happened on Twitter with people paying for a blue tick was a car crash. So many people have paid and then are impersonating some sort of public figure or some sort of even like the police. So it was a car crash. So I'm kind of like, so out of all the things that you could have copied, you copied that. So it just feels like there's going to be no way to differentiate between somebody who has just paid for a blue tick and someone who is actually a public figure that is recognized for what they do, which can be really dangerous, right? Because if then you decide that you're like, you want to impersonate an activist or a politician to do them harm, you can do it that way. So I think there are added benefits, but one...
What is going on where you are? Something is going on there.
I live in Hackney. So I live next to a hospital. So somebody must have fallen over or something. So I was just waiting to let it die down.
Yeah, no worries.
But yeah, I was actually asked in an interview about whether people should bother paying for Meta Verified. And so far I've said no, particularly if you're a sex worker or someone who isn't already well-liked by Meta, because first of all, it's only on a real name basis, and a lot of people cannot have their real name on platforms. And secondly, again, if Meta already says we're actually deprioritizing nudity and all sorts of naked content, then why should you pay a company that is not going to do right by you anyway? So wow. I wouldn't recommend that. But going back to what you said about, you know, it's just a social platform, it's not your right. I think I agree to that. Partly in the sense that, you know, a lot of people are like, I'm being silenced. They're claiming they're being silenced from the height of their newspaper columns. Like, even when Trump was deplatformed from social media, it's not like he disappeared from the, you know, from the face of the earth. But I think, as you said, you rely on Meta and on Instagram because that's your job. It depends on it. So I think it's not, let's say it's not necessarily like a human right in the sense that, you know, it's a right to safety. But if people have an OnlyFans and people's OnlyFans relies on their following on Instagram, and then Instagram deletes their account and then they have no other way to direct people to their OnlyFans, and their OnlyFans was their only source of income because maybe they are disabled or chronically ill, or, you know, it was the safest way for them to work, then, mm-hmm. you know, safety really comes into it. So yes, maybe someone posting pictures of their food for shits and giggles getting deplatformed is not a huge deal, but it is a huge deal for some people who are then essentially excluded from work opportunities or for self-expression, from education, from learning opportunities. Like, you know, I think of a lot of LGBTQ plus people, particularly from conservative cultures. They do not have access to safe and reliable sexual health information because that's not given to them. And a lot of those people have been able to find that information through social media platforms. So I think that's where the line becomes really, really blurred. And as much as, yes, they're a private company, it's kind of like you should do better.
I know what you're saying. Yeah. And I do agree. I'm so in between. Like, I kind of see both sides, only from because I own a business. So I know how hard it is to run a business and you can't please everyone. So I agree with you as well. And I also understand their side. And I guess it's that whole thing of thinking that, well, if you worked in an office and you did something at that office that wasn't allowed in the office and you got fired, you wouldn't then say, oh, that job and now meaning that I can't pay my bills because of them. You wouldn't be like, you wouldn't try to put it onto them, you know, when you've done something wrong. Do you know what I mean? So it's really difficult to then be like, well, why are we doing the same to Meta? They basically told us that you've broken the rules, you've been kicked off. And then we're trying to say, oh, well, you know, this is actually a safety issue. You've caused like problems to my safety because I can't afford to, you know, pay my... And then it's that whole thing of like, well, is that Meta's problem? It shouldn't be because they've told you that this is the deal. But then, yeah, this is why I'm saying I'd rather pay for it, because then I might feel like I actually have some fucking rights. Do you know what I mean? I might be like, well, actually, I pay for this, so I want to know what the fuck's going on. That's the only thing that would tempt me to Meta. So when it does roll out here, the only thing that might tempt me is not for the extra views and stuff. The views and stuff I'm not really too bothered about anymore, because I feel like my followers are with me and they're going to be the ones who just stay now. I think I've gotten to a point where I probably can't grow much more. There's only so many pole dancers, right? So like, I'm not looking for approval of people outside of pole either, because that's not really my area of expertise. So it's the whole thing of like, I feel like I've kind of got my customers now and my followers, and I enjoy my time with them. So I'm not looking for the extra content views or anything like that. But what I am interested in is the safety in knowing that actually, if my account did get deleted or whatever, I would have someone's contact. But that for me is like, it's the peace of mind thing. Like, too, when I get the worst anxiety when I open up at Instagram and the screen is white and I know it's about to bring up a message from Instagram to tell me I've done something wrong. I shit myself because I'm like, is today the day? I'm like, is this the day they're going to get rid of my account? Like, because if it is, I'm pretty fucked, to be honest. Like, I am completely screwed.
Yeah, like, who are you going to contact? Right. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, that's where...
I'm going to contact you.
You know.
I'll be like, yeah, help me.
You're very welcome to contact me. As I said, it might take them ages to help. But, like, this is where the appeals stuff is really important. And this is where it becomes a human rights kind of due process kind of thing. Because yes, if you've broken a rule and you know what the penalty for that is and you do it anyway, fair enough. But a lot of people who get deleted did not break that rule and they have no way of saying, I did not break that rule. Please speak to me. So it's kind of like, well, where do we draw the line about deleting someone straight away? And why are we not informing them about why they got deleted? Why is there no way to reach out to anyone when people get deleted? That's where, you know, all of these steps make this a failure of justice. If it was just like deletion, oh, we were wrong, sorry, here you go again, then it'd be like, okay, fine, you know, you're doing your job, I was doing mine, there was a misunderstanding and we fixed it. But there is no way to fix that misunderstanding at the moment, and that's where it goes really wrong. And I think, yeah, that's really the main thing, because it's a system that doesn't work. And as I said, like, I think what happens in these rooms is that products get designed and they're like, this is so amazing. This is so cool. Look what we did. But then they don't plan for when things go wrong. And then it's very hard to reverse the process when things go wrong. And I think that comes from a lack of humility within those tech circles of them thinking that they're going to do things right every time, which is not the case, clearly.
Do you think, this is kind of totally separate, and again, an area I don't really know much about, but I know it's being used kind of everywhere. Like, do you think AI will ever be used to help with things like this?
I mean, I just don't think so far there is enough nuance in the AI to improve these kind of issues, because at the moment, a lot of detection and deletions are completely algorithmic.
Right.
So already they're being
used. Which means a human's not doing it, isn't it? It's all... So what's the... When you say like it's algorithmic, it means like a computer is doing the decisions for you. So it's kind of similar to AI, right? It's like programs to do this and detect it.
Yeah, so a lot of detection of nudity, for instance, is automated. So it's AI, which makes, for instance, the process of appealing for shadow banning completely... Oh my God, it's doing my head in. I don't know if it's ever happened to anybody, but basically what happens is you go into account status, you look at your ticks. Is there two green ticks? Great, you're in the green, you've done nothing.
What have you got, by the way? Have you got two green ticks?
At the moment, I've got two green ticks, but as soon as I post a new video, then I will go back into the shadows, because it's not just the new video that gets picked up, it's also the old videos that they had previously appealed. So the AI keeps detecting the same things over and over again, which means that this process is still not smooth, which is one problem with the AI. Another problem is the intersection of the AI and their policies, because again, you were saying, well, I've broken a rule, therefore I deserve punishment. The thing is, there is a sneaky type of punishment on Meta, which is implied solicitation. So basically, it means that if at the same time you've got a very spicy account with spicy content and are asking people to contact you or find your stuff elsewhere. So if you say, send me a DM, link in my bio, hit me up wherever, those two elements constitute implied solicitation. Now, the issue is, because Meta is so conservative, you can't really know what constitutes a suggestive element for them. And because suggestive elements are picked up by the AI, a lot of those suggestive elements are literally just women living their lives, like women in leggings, women with a sports bra, women even going to the doctor, like women having a breast scan. A lot of that stuff can be viewed according to mistakes in machine learning and also biases amongst those who made those algorithms as suggestive elements. So I don't see AI doing too well without some sort of human check and balance in the middle.
I remember seeing this post about like, oh, don't say that a link is in your bio or anything, because like you said about the solicitation thing, I remember seeing that posted somewhere and I remember thinking, that's so odd though, because, you know, that's the whole point of us having a link there. Like, what, otherwise, what is that for? Do you know what I mean? So that's why we say link in our bio, because there's a link to our website, especially if it's a business page like ASOS.com. They're going to have a link, aren't they? Because that's where their website is. So I think it's more that they're trying to target people putting OnlyFans or whatever. But if that's the case, then just block it so that they can't put an OnlyFans link if that's what you hate so much. But it's just, yeah, and it's just annoying to think that someone, some poor old lady who just wants to promote her cake business, I don't know, and she puts, oh, I've put the link in my bio for this cake recipe. And can you imagine if she got blocked because she'd been soliciting? Do you know what I mean? It's like,
for cake.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's just like, I don't know. I find the whole, my only thing with Instagram is that I would just love to have some security in it. Like, so it's funny you mentioned about the ticks and stuff, and I'm just going to go over this now for anyone who is wondering what we're talking about. If you go to your Instagram and you go to, I think it's settings and privacy.
And then all the way down in help.
To help. Yeah, so go down to help, and then you click on account status. Now, mine at the moment is orange, green, green. So I've had stuff removed, which has then made mine go like amber, so I've got like a warning on there, but it stays on there for a year because I've got stuff that from November 2022 that now won't go away until November this year. So that means that I've basically got that on my account now until November. Well, this is the funniest one, right? I've got one on here for hate speech, and I had gone onto someone's profile. I actually think it might have been my friend Shan, actually. And I've been like, oh, I see you, you sexy bish. And I didn't even write bitch. I wrote bish. And someone must have reported or something, and it got marked as hate speech because I called them a sexy. No, I think I just put, I see you, bish, or something like that, and then just put some eyes or something. I wonder if I'd put sexy bish, maybe it would have just been like, oh, okay, they're being nice. And I was like, what? I appealed it and nothing happened. It's just that whole thing of like, that is so annoying because that is now sat on my account. Don't get me wrong, that's on there until July, so that'll be gone soon. You know, you're just like, what the fuck? Like, I'm trying my best to behave. Don't get me wrong, the other thing that's on there is that I posted like a half-naked picture of me. But my defense was that I put an emoji over the, it was to show a tan line, right? So I was showing a tan line and I put this emoji over it. But I think that what it did was, so I put the picture up, and then in the app, I put a sticker over it. Now, I don't know if Instagram detect that there is a sticker over the picture when they're checking the photos. I would assume maybe not, because what I put over it was pretty much covering the whole area. Like, I mean, there's people that wear these tiny thongs in like bodybuilding competitions that cover way less than what I was covering with this emoji. And I was just like, why is that missing down? I peeled it, no luck. It got declined. I was like, this is just bullshit.
So you see, this is where the context thing and a human instead of AI would be really helpful, because, right, you know, when you wrote your comment to your friend, like, clearly that was not an insult, but clearly that's some sort of AI picking that up. I've found that with a lot of my participants from the queer community, or even from like different ethnic backgrounds, that basically if you reclaim anti-gay slurs as a queer person, for some reason you get done for hate speech. But if some dude posts that in your comments, they're fine. Similarly, yeah, hate, like not even hate, but like something saying like a joke about white people is picked up as racism, while a lot of really bad actual racial attacks against people of color are not picked up in the same way. But I think what's interesting about your emoji story is that it depends on the emoji that you chose, because I think they, like, amongst the implicit solicitation thing, so for the implicit solicitation to happen, you need to have something spicy. So the lady with the cake business, unless she's posing naked with her cake in her hands, technically she wouldn't get done for it. But if you, let's say, cover your modesty with like an aubergine emoji or like a wet water emoji or like a drooling emoji, that could be seen as sexual content. So emojis are also seen as sexual content, so it kind of depends.
It was, oh, that was what it was. So, you know, and funny enough, so I couldn't use this at first, but then all of a sudden it started working, so I shared this. It was one of those things where it was like, oh, share an old picture of you, and then you click on it and it'll let you choose a picture, and then you put it on there so other people can join in with it on your stories. So I did that, and I put the little sticker of where it said share an old picture of you, I put it over where my dick was, basically. But I had my hand covering it as well. And yeah, so I remember putting that over it, and then that got banned. I just thought, like, so again, not like, I wouldn't say it was like overly sexual at all. It was just basically where I'd had this like fake tan, and my fake tan was like, but I literally had zoomed it so far in that even my hand, everything was all covered. So I was like, oh, I'm good. And then it got taken down. I was like, what the fuck?
But, and also just the fact that nudity is blended with sex, right? Like, just the fact that we share a body doesn't always mean that we're engaging in a sex act, right?
Yeah.
So it's a bit weird that you're not allowed to have a body on these platforms where you literally see bodies everywhere. You know, I like, you see naked people everywhere.
It's just so difficult for them to, like you said, it's so difficult to them to be able to tell. It's like when you said about the gay slurs and stuff. I mean, like, I've got friends, we'll say fag to each other all the time because we just think it's hilarious to claim it back, like you said. But I'd never write fag on social media because I know, even though if I wrote to my friend Stephen, was like, oh, you're looking good, you big fag, like, we'd know it's funny. But it takes someone else to think, oh, fuck, like, they're being homophobic. I'm going to report that. So that's why I would never comment stuff like that. I even actually, I won't even call people a sexy bitch anymore because I'm worried about saying bitch. And it's that whole thing of, like, I'm just too scared to do stuff now. And it's sad, really, because I feel like I'm restricting what I do on social media. I mean, I'm always scared that Polox is going to get taken down because obviously we share fails on there. And obviously we want to make sure that people aren't visibly really badly hurt in the videos because that can get taken down. We're always like walking the line on that. So, I mean, where do you think the future is with all this, with social media stuff? Where do you think we're going?
So as much as I hate saying this, I think it's really important for people to think of a backup plan. So to think, you know, if I know my business relies on social media, but if I were to lose this, what would I do? Because I think, like, what we've seen with Twitter, when Elon Musk went and bought Twitter and then laid off a bunch of staff, and then the platform is still finding its feet, it just feels like the tech bubble is going to burst. At least that's the way I'm looking at it. Because I think when it started, there was no regulation, and now they are weighed down by the price of regulation, like literally the cost of regulation, because they need to find new technologies to, you know, implement the new rules and whatever. And then I think they're going through a lot more scrutiny. So I don't think social media is going to die, but I think what's really interesting to me, if you compare Instagram with TikTok, right? Instagram is where your community lies. Twitter as well, but Instagram is where your community lies. This is where you find your people. It's very supportive if you think about it. Like, most of the time, your followers are people that genuinely care about what you post. TikTok, however, is an entertainment platform. You said it yourself. You don't go on TikTok for poll. You go on TikTok for entertainment. It's where, it's your happy place to find content. So it's almost like a channel, like a broadcast tool. So it feels like because TikTok is on the up and Instagram is on the way down, it feels like we're moving towards entertainment rather than just social. So I think partly as creators, we're trying to grasp where things are going next, and things go to the next step really, really fast. So there will always be a new platform. Just make sure you know where your audience lies and that you hold on to that audience. So I did a really fun because we were fun, but depressing because what we were talking about was depressing, seminar with Indie Pole and with Gemma Rose. And Gemma was like, look, when I lost my account, I just didn't know what to do. So she built a website, which I think is a really important thing, because you need to make sure that people have somewhere to go, even if the social media hellscape fails. So mm-hmm. I think it's important to think where your strengths lie and how you can still reach people even outside of social media. I do think we're facing more regulations. The European Union is coming up with the Digital Services Act, which is actually really good and could force platforms to stop with shadow banning and to at least tell people why their content is being restricted. In the UK, we've got the Online Safety Bill, which was made by the Tory government. So it's a car crash. This is where I show my politics, but also it's not just because it was made by the Tories. It's also that they've ignored all sorts of advice from experts, from freedom of expression experts, from privacy experts. So it just seems like it's something that cares more about keeping people happy with their social media panic rather than to actually tackle the issues in social media, because there's virtually nothing for victims of abuse, for instance. Mm-hmm. So I just think we're going towards more regulation. I don't trust the UK or the US, given, you know, how radical politics is getting there, to do a good job with social media regulation. And obviously platforms exist like any other company, and they're going to have to respect that type of regulation. So I think we're going towards an increasingly regulated and increasingly messy social media space. I think that's where we're going.
Yeah, it's a little bit scary anyway, isn't it? Because it's just, like you said, it's the whole thing. Like, so did Gemma have her account deleted?
So Gemma had her account deleted, I think it was last year. And then we managed to get it back. Okay. But like some, you know, like one of her backups is still down, like all of that stuff. So again, for someone like Gemma who straddles both worlds, right? Like literally, she's a pole instructor and a performer, and she's also a sex worker and an activist. All of that is incredibly necessary to promote herself. So I think she's been really smart in starting a website. I think, you know, sometimes just taking matters in your own hands is probably the best thing to do.
I remember Carmine Black posting once and then saying something like, you know, we can't rely on these platforms. Make sure you're building up your mailing list. It's so true. Like, I mean, I have a mailing list as well. Probably I need to be better with it, and I don't promote it enough, because I'm always running new things, and I never email people and tell them I'm terrible. I need to do it more. But, you know, I do have quite a good mailing list. I've obviously got all of my online students. I have their contact details. So I have contacts. But for people, especially within the sex work industry, it must be really difficult, because obviously they're probably not taking people's contact details. They're probably just, they'd sign up on OnlyFans, and that's kind of the only contact they have with them. And obviously that, I would assume they probably don't get their contact details. I'd assume, probably not. So yeah, it's not like they can even just email all of their OnlyFans people and be like, hey, I had my account deleted, whatever. So yeah, it's difficult for them. But one thing I would say, if you're a pole dancer listening and you do this professionally, is, oh God, definitely have a mailing list. Oh my God, it's like so useful. I mean, not just useful for if obviously your account ever gets deleted, but it's useful for me in terms of like sales and letting people know what I'm doing and what classes I've got going on, what countries I'm going to. So it's really, really useful for things like that. But
But you know, it's kind of like you said, it's tiring to have to keep up all of these streams. Like a big part of my research at the moment, it's talking about the invisible labor of the creator economy, right? Because as pole dancers, I think we're also, and sex workers as well, obviously, we're content creators, right? It's like a gig economy way of living, where we're paid by the service kind of thing. And to be able to exist on platforms, we have to think about not being censored. We have to think about what happens if we are censored. We have to think about backup plans, backup accounts, backup mailing lists and websites. We are spreading ourselves thin while the actual money that we make is from that tiny little sale. But there is so much unpaid labor that goes into this whole ecosystem, which is exhausting. And not everybody's got time for that.
It is so funny because people always say to me, like, how do you do like all the stuff that you do? And then I'm like, honey, you don't know half of it. Like, honestly, don't even realize. Like, I have an assistant as well, and I'm still always crazy. Like, even with an assistant, I could only imagine what my life would be like without her. Fuck my life. But like, yeah, there's so much that goes behind it. Like, just little things like, it's not just the recording the content, you know, it's not just that, it's the editing the content. What am I going to write in my caption? What hashtags am I going to use? All these little things, editing the video maybe, all these little things. It's not as easy as just whacking a video up. It takes time. And yeah, and that's obviously just one part of what I do. So it's crazy really how much time we do, but like you say, how much time does go into social media. And it makes me understand a lot more why you see so many people kind of just like stopping with it and just not bothering anymore. Like when Tiff Finney stopped, I kind of got it. I was like, do you know what? I get it. I actually see why she's doing that, because it's fucking draining. Some people it's just too much, but luckily I'm kind of, with the help of an assistant and stuff, it does help. But like, it's, yeah, some days I just get to the point where I'm just like, I just can't fucking be bothered. I'm just so drained from this. Like, social media is super draining. Do you find, how do you feel social media is on your mental health?
It's not great, to be honest. Like, I started, I completely agree with you. Like, I started because I actually found a lot of joy in creating content, and I still do. I like sharing what I do with the world. I think Paul has been so healing for me and like a massive outlet for self-expression. And I love writing, so I love sharing my writing. But like, I'm at a point where I'm like, you know, I have, let's say, three platforms where I'm fairly big. So Twitter with academics, Instagram and TikTok with pole dancers, and with the old dudes who love watching me dance to metal on TikTok, who are my main following, to be honest. And then I have it's that, and then I have That's my amazing. blog. It's so random, which means that if I want to sell a class, I can't sell it to them because it's old dudes just looking at my ass. But you know, I appreciate the support. And then I've got my blog, and then I've got my newsletter. So there's all of that. And then if you put that on top of me having a full-time job where I also have to produce a lot of content, which is like pages and pages of academic papers, it's very draining. And then I think for me, the added stress is actually this contact that I have with Instagram, because I feel almost like personally responsible to help people. And at the same time, because I care. Not because of whatever, like, because I know what it feels like to lose an account. I've been deplatformed by Instagram once and by TikTok four times, and it sucks. So, and I know that, you know, I have a source of income, but a lot of people don't outside of social media. So I really care about it. So I feel very personally responsible. And every time I get a notification or a message by someone saying, help me, I want to help them. But at the same time, it's like an extra added bit of anxiety, because it's like another person needs my help and I might not be able to help them. Like, yeah. Because if they don't respond to me, I'm not helping this person.
But I don't think no one's going to blame you. I mean, people, oh God, I wouldn't, if you couldn't get my account back, I wouldn't be like, oh my God, it's your fault. Of course not. It's probably just like, but it is an added pressure, isn't it? Because of course we're a community, aren't we? And we always want to help other people within the pole community and stuff. So it's always really hard when it's like, oh, I can't help this person. I feel really bad.
Well, and as you said, this is the internet, so there is a lot going on, and there have been people that have legit demanded my time. Like, there have been people that have legit been like, you are not helping me, like, what are you doing? Like, I wrote to you yesterday and you still haven't responded, or like, you still haven't told me if they recovered my account or not. And I'm like, babe, like, I every time someone asks me for help, I'm like, yes, I will send that email. It's up to them when they respond. It's up to them whether they recover the account. If you don't hear from me, it means I haven't heard from them. And yet there's still people that are like, you know, why are you not doing more? And I'm like, this is all I can do. I'm so sorry. Right.
But that's just entitlement. But I think, and that's a completely different conversation I'd go off on. But like, we've got a lot of entitled people within pole who feel like they're owed something. And it's like, honey, you're not owed anything by anyone. Like, especially not someone who's doing you a favor. That really pisses me off. If someone did that to me, I just wouldn't even respond to them. So good for you for actually responding.
I feel bad at not responding because I understand that everybody reacts in a different way in a situation that is very stressful. But I also just think, you know, just realize that I'm doing this for free.
Yes.
And I think a big help that I've had at the moment is that I'm with like a talent manager, like an agent who is super, super helpful. And she also represents a lot of people within like the sexy content creation space. So something that I also found really, really stressful was, you know, deciding which brand partnership to take up. How much should I charge these people? Should I even work with these people? And I think working with someone who has my back, knows how much I should charge, knows if I should bother with someone or not, that is already a major help. But I think this is also why, you know, I had to leave teaching, because I was dealing with so many things at the same time that I just needed Paul to be a space for me where I could dance and let go and train. And if I had to think about, you know, making good choreos and selling classes, like sometimes I just want to do a messy freestyle. And I think it's actually helpful for me to let go of a few things. Mm-hmm. So I think what I'm learning on social media, but in life at the moment, is just being able to say no and learning where I need to kind of take a step back.
Yeah, that's good. I think it's really important. Listen, thank you so much for coming on. I noticed we were going for like an hour and 10 minutes. Like, oh my God. But it's been so fun talking.
We're so chatty.
I know. But it's an annoying subject because it's one of those things where, like, you know, this, we know that this podcast won't change anything. And obviously, it's just that whole thing of like, I wish there was more that could be done, but it's nice to talk about it and to raise awareness of what is going on. And it's, you know, thank you so much for all the work that you're doing. You're doing great. And for anyone who wants to try and find out more about you and follow this work that you're doing, give us like websites, Instagram handles, give us all the things. Go.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. And congrats to anyone who got this far for our rants. So I am pretty much all over the internet at Blogger on Paul. So my handle will always be Blogger on Paul, whether that's Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, Mastodon, Reddit, like literally everything, I am there. My blog is bloggeronpaul.com, and you will see a lot of different pages on it. So if you look for books and research, that's where you can find my academic papers. Otherwise, on the homepage, you'll be able to find both my blog posts and my Buy Me a Coffee, which is where I sell my class recordings. I have been so slack and I haven't recorded a class in ages, but I'm trying to slowly go back into it because a few people are asking me and I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry, I did too many things. But I, you know, like the recordings that you find on Buy Me a Coffee are there for life, so it's not like they expire. So if you just want to shake your ass to heavy metal with me, you can do it on there. So I think that's pretty much it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope that we'll get thank to meet you. Up again soon, but until then,
yeah.
Bye.
See you. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I really hope you enjoyed it. And make sure you go and support Carolina on her journey to trying to fight Instagram and get us the justice that we deserve. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And until next time, bye. That was all the tea that you can get this week. Join me next time right here. It's the Weekly Tea.